Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3020, United States of America versus Anton H. Blalock, appellant. Mr. Sussman for the appellant, Mr. Ambrosino for the appellee.
Morning, Your Honor. While the matter of a client receiving extra time in prison is never one to be taken lightly, I can't help having the feeling this morning I'm kind of in the middle of a law school hypothetical. The facts of this case are about as bizarre as one could really imagine, and I think they have to be looked at. What if on a mid-morning on a sunny May day, an individual drives up in front of a police station, in this case the 7th District, leaves his car blocking traffic and gets out and retrieves a bag and immediately starts firing a semi-automatic weapon in the air. At the same time, he's heard to make various statements. One of them, why won't the police let us sell our marijuana on 22nd Street? He also makes a reference to promoting his label, a CD reference. In fact, his car is emblazoned with advertisements for a musical CD that he's produced. He discharges his gun until it's empty. The police emerge on the scene, and in response to police directives, he throws the gun down and immediately does what one would expect. He removes all his clothes and stands on Alabama Avenue on a busy morning. He's subdued and taken to the hospital, and at the same time, other police officers find a number of small bags containing marijuana scattered on the sidewalk. At the hospital, the medical records reveal that his pulse rate is extremely elevated, his blood pressure is something like 211 over, I don't know the lower number, clearly a treatable hypertensive crisis. He's considered to be angry and confused, and he makes further statements about his CD and promoting music sales. From this episode, eventually the defendant pleads guilty to the crime of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, a general intent crime. Left open is the question of whether his sentence should be enhanced by a guideline factor which requires a four-level upward adjustment if the firearm is possessed in connection with another felony offense. According to the government, that felony offense is possession with intent to distribute marijuana, a specific intent offense. And it was the defense position at sentencing, and again today, that there is a lack of evidence by any standard that would support the application of that particular enhancement. The court, in applying the enhancement, takes what it considers to be a common sense approach. Now, I'm all for common sense. There's obviously too little of it in the world, but in this case, I think the court made it too simple. That this was a far more complicated matter than a layman might see it. The layman might see the connection. There's a gun. There's drugs. Obviously. End of story. Ergo, it's somewhat that the intent is clearly established by those factors. It's I think it's somewhat equivalent to saying that our Washington Nationals have a propensity for losing, and when they take the field, they seem to lose with incredible regularity. I do not think they have gotten to the point where their intent is to lose when they take the field, and I think that's where the court misstepped, because I think inferring that Mr. Blalock had the intent to distribute marijuana at that particular time.
What you said at that particular time. Why does it have to be at that particular time?
Because that's all we know.
Well, they're in their baggies, right?
Which that's
are
correct.
Typically used for distribution.
Right. I think that was conceded in the plea. The government pointed that out, and
so I think the district court pointed out that they're. doesn't necessarily have to be a temporal proximity of the kind that you're requiring at that precise moment that he's in front of the police station that he was intending to distribute. But he obviously possessed it at that time, and the intent to distribute could have been before or after.
Well, that's pure speculation. We know nothing about when he got it.
We know he had it.
We know it was scattered on the street, and one would imagine that if we use common sense in this particular case, uniformed police officers are generally a poor source for selling marijuana, or any drug for that matter, that the purpose was not at that particular time to distribute marijuana. It might have been displayed.
Yeah, I think you have a decent argument to that effect, but I'm not sure it has to be looked at through so narrow a lens. That's all I'm asking.
Well, if the correlation, you know, it's interesting. In the application note to this particular offense, particular enhancement, which I don't think is very helpful, talks about whether a weapon has the facilitates or has the potential to facilitate a particular offense. I mean, a gun always has the potential to facilitate a large number of offenses, and that's kind of a meaningless standard, I would submit. And I think what the court is saying is,
can we regard it as such? I mean, we do have an application note. We are supposed to follow them. It says where the other offense is a drug trafficking offense in which a firearm is found in close proximity to drugs. Application is warranted because the presence of the firearm has the potential of facilitating another felony offense. I appreciate that that's a disputable proposition, but it is the Sentencing Commission's proposition.
I understand, but if you use the propensity of a weapon to facilitate, then you can speculate about any crime. But,
so are you asking us to say that to disregard the application?
I am, because I think that this case is, I know how the court, as a general matter, doesn't like your recitation of facts, but this case is entirely fact-driven. And
what do you think, I don't disagree with you about that. If that's the case, is our standard of review, for example, is in connection with, is that a fact? And if so, is a fact question? And therefore, is our standard of review just clearly erroneous?
I think that is the standard. I can't change the standard. I think that the notion that purely establishing a temporal connection between two events establishes some link that triggers the application of this enhancement is inappropriate.
If this were to go to the jury there was this evidence, would we say it was insufficient? If the jury found guilty, would we say it was insufficient? The evidence was insufficient to establish that no reasonable jury could conclude?
I would say that as a beyond the reasonable doubt
right,
matter.
Right, right. And so now we have all you need is preponderance, right?
That's correct.
So now we'd have to say no reasonable judge could conclude by a preponderance. In fact, I'm not sure what the difference between that and clear error is, but probably clear error is even a tougher standard for you. How can we say it's clear error under those circumstances?
Well, I think under these facts, one can say that. The court actually, in making its decision, used what would amount to a jury argument. Uh-huh. The court said, you know, average guy, if you ask them, what do these two things have to do with each other? And, you know, guns and drugs, it's a clear kind of connection. I think that that's a layman's take on it, and this is not a decision that a layman is making or should be making. This is a fairly, if you will, and a kind of an esoteric kind of issue about what was my client doing with the drugs at the particular time. You can speculate that he had the drugs for months and was planning to sell them, that he's a drug seller. You can speculate a lot of things. But at the particular point in time...
Why do you require speculation there? Because he himself said, didn't he, that he wanted to be able to sell it? Wasn't that part of what he said?
He said, why don't the police let us sell our drugs? I mean,
why can't from that statement you infer that he intended to distribute?
Well, that's sort of a use of almost a 404B, other crimes evidence, as a propensity. As a propensity analysis, the fact that Mr. Blalock might have been more than willing on other occasions to sell marijuana, I don't think is dispositive of what he was doing with it on that particular day. I mean, the drugs could have been used for display purposes as part of some normal protest or something about the marijuana laws. It could have been. This was clearly not a distribution as such. I mean, this is an display, an abandonment, whatever you want to call it. But clearly the purpose was not at that particular time to sell or distribute drugs. If the court wants to go back and say, well, at a previous time, these drugs were possessed with the distributive intent, then I think the court is into the realm of purely speculating as to when he got the drugs. Perhaps he obtained those drugs with no other purpose than to bring them to the police station and display them. If you assume that, then the specific intent for distribution is negated, and
there
is
not consistent with what he said, according to the evidence.
Well, he said a lot of things. I mean, and most of them were fairly inane. You know, he may well have been there to get arrested, or his best chance was to get himself killed, probably, but or to enhance his career as a rapper through arrest. I'm told that that's a path to success in that business. But
you've raised a very, I mean, I would say this is, I agree with the district court judge that you've represented this client extremely well. You've raised an issue I don't.
I'm sorry.
You've raised an issue that I'll say it louder if you'd like. I think you have represented him very well. And I think you raised an issue that wasn't immediately apparent to me. This is why I'm pressing you on the application note issue, because by using the words has the potential of facilitating, it does sound like you're talking about something that might happen in the future or in the past, but not necessarily happening immediately. I take it that's why you think we'd have to disregard the application.
I think the analysis is the here and now. Uh-huh. I think when you depart with regard to other factual scenarios, you're really not focusing on the issue at hand. I think you could say that this guy, by virtue of statements, has denominated himself a marijuana seller. That's hardly dispositive of the question of what his intent was at that very moment. And I'm saying that the extremely bizarre nature of this whole event negates and the drug taking certainly negates the kind of specific intent that would be required to make the finding here.
Somebody were had this amount of drugs, or maybe 10 times as much, but had a religious conversion as he was walking in a certain direction, and said, you know, I'm done, I'm not going to sell anymore. And we had some method of lie detecting, and it was, you know, everybody could completely agree that he no longer possessed with intent, but that he did an hour ago. Can he not be convicted for having done it an hour ago?
If you can prove that he possessed those drugs an hour ago with the intent to distribute them.
Right, but if the evidence of intent to distribute is the fact of having drugs that everybody can in a packaging that was conceded indicated intent, Wouldn't it be acceptable, that is reasonable, to find by preponderance that an hour ago he had that intent, even if he doesn't have it now?
I don't disagree with that, but I don't think the court is putting into its hypothetical the particularly bizarre nature that we see here. If the average guy is walking down the street with that kind of packaging, I mean, we see those cases all the time, where a search leads to the disclosure of those things, the experts testify it's consistent, and at least my client seems to go to jail for that. The question really here is when you superimpose the rest of the story, which is not insignificant.
And bizarre, you're right.
That you have a different factual scenario, and that's my story.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sussman.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mike Lambrosino for the United States. I think the parties agree on the facts of this case, and it's really just the application of those facts to the law. The intent comes from based on the facts that were set forth in the plea proffer. The requisite intent comes from appellant's statement at the very moment that he discharged the firearm in this case. And from the fact that he was in possession of drugs that were packaged in a manner that was consistent with distribution. Counsel talked about what he was doing at that very moment with the contraband, but that's not the issue. The issue was what could the district court judge reasonably conclude by using the preponderance standard about his intent, not his actions, but his intent. And his intent, he stated his intent. I don't think there are many cases where we actually have, without some kind of undercover person with a tape recording, where the appellant's intent is actually stated.
Well, he couldn't have intended to distribute it at the police station.
No, but that's not what's necessary. That would be an actual distribution case, Your Honor.
And he couldn't have intended, well, what's your answer on, could he have intended to distribute it in the future?
Well, that's essentially what I would submit, Your Honor, that is what possession with intent to distribute, because the nature of the charge itself is that you're possessing the contraband with an intent to distribute it at some future date.
Is that logical when you're standing in front of the police station knowing you're going to get arrested for firing it?
I think it's logical for three reasons. I think when you go to the very moment that the appellant's discharging the firearm, he's stating his intent. If you look at the level of intoxication here to try to discern whether or not he somehow negated his ability to formulate the specific intent, you can look at his actions just prior to the time he discharges his firearm, at which time he has his wits about him enough that he can operate his automobile. And he drives it to the very location where he wants to go. He goes to the police department. He parks out front. He then goes and retrieves his firearm from the back of his trunk. So this was something that had been secreted previously. It wasn't something that was in his immediate possession. He knew where to go to retrieve it. He walks directly to the back of the trunk. There's no evidence that he was somehow stumbling, unable to walk a straight line. And after he retrieves it, he fires it into the air and states his intent. But also, I think that his level of intoxication can be gleaned also from the events that occur immediately afterwards, and that is that despite his intoxication, and the prosecutor said below that she did not dispute that he was, in fact, intoxicated. That was not in dispute. The only thing that was in dispute, really, was his level of intoxication. When confronted with deadly force, he put down his weapon. Now, admittedly, he also got undressed. Which clearly demonstrates a lack of an ambition. But what's not demonstrated on the record is an inability to, what's not demonstrated on the record is that he was out of touch with reality, that he was unable to control.
Does it matter whether he was, he lacked the ability to make the intent at that moment? That is, or even in the future, was the evidence available there sufficient to establish a prior crime? That is, that at some earlier time, since he took the gun out of the trunk and he took the packaged drugs out of the trunk, obviously at some point they had to have been in his trunk or collected by him or brought together by him in a way that at least circumstantially indicates intent, even if not at the moment at which he's stripping.
I would say two things in response, Your Honor. The first is that from the facts in the proffer itself, I submit that the district court judge had the evidence before him to reasonably conclude that although intoxicated, this appellant was not intoxicated to the level that it negated his ability to formulate specific intent at that time. I would state secondly, Your Honor, that there were clearly facts before the court in the record from which the district court judge could reasonably conclude that the more likely inference was that even if assuming a level of intoxication that would have somehow interfered with his ability to formulate specific intent at that time, that he clearly, more likely than not, obtained these drugs at a time when he was able to formulate that specific intent. I would submit that it would be highly unlikely that someone would just somehow accidentally come into possession of 23 Ziplocs of marijuana or accidentally package them in a manner that would be consistent with distribution. If someone were that intoxicated, I would submit they'd probably get robbed and not be able to purchase drugs for distribution. And so I think a district court judge, I think that's really the only reasonable inference that could have been drawn from that. Is it possible that he was somehow completely intoxicated at the time he obtained them and someone just threw these drugs in his lap, anything could happen. But I think based on the record that was before the district court could quite reasonably conclude that appellant had this weapon, he had secreted it in the trunk, and he secreted it along with the drugs. They were put in the same place. And from those facts, and the fact that in accordance with the plea proffer, there was a bag of marijuana and a separate number of Ziplocs that were individually packaged for distribution, that he could reasonably conclude that he came into possession of both the gun and the marijuana at a prior time when he was, in fact, not intoxicated and thus capable of forming the requisite intent. And that's really the issue in a nutshell. If Your Honors don't have any further questions, I think that's about all I have.
Anything further?
Okay. We ask that the sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you need a minute, Mr. Sussman?
Just a minute. I think in response to something that Judge Garland brought up about the past criminal behavior, I think that we're totally in the realm of speculation. Who knows how this factual scenario developed? One could readily say that that this guy got high that morning, conceived in his mind of this notion, maybe had a gun before, maybe decided to get marijuana and go out and make a protest at the police station, or that this would be a good way of promoting his music. I mean, the notion, I'm somewhat amused by the notion that this is not a removal of specific intent, but somehow a removal of inhibition, sort of like somebody with few too many singing off key at the karaoke bar. This, the bizarre nature of this is totally, in my mind, negates specific intent for some substantial
I, I'm, in, I'm amused wouldn't be the word I use, but I would say interested in the this different. I didn't realize there was a difference legally between lack of inhibition and lack of intent. Are there cases on this distinction?
I had not looked into that because I really didn't focus on that until I reread the government's brief. I don't think lack of inhibition rises to the level of specific intent. I don't. Many of us are not inhibited for a variety of reasons. In particular circumstances, I think this is really thwarts one's ability to form the intent to do anything rational. And in this case, that was selling marijuana.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.